especially if you're in a leadership position, if someone shares a perspective, an idea, constructive feedback, whatever, your job is literally to encourage that behavior. It doesn't matter if you don't agree. That's how we move forward.
That was Kina Jungmann, a professional coach and leadership developer whose presence fills the room with energy. She has both a deep understanding and an unending interest in personal development and growth. She is an inspiring speaker and a compassionate coach with the ability to see past the noise to how human interactions are affecting the workplace. How is a high-performing team created? What is psychological safety in organizations? What are core competencies for an efficient leadership? And how does simply allowing yourself and others to be human create change?
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
How are you doing today?
I'm really good, actually.
You seem really good.
Yeah, I had a good night's sleep and I had a calm morning. My husband took the daughter to kindergarten.
You had a calm morning.
I had a calm morning.
Oh, that's almost unheard of. So today I thought we were going to talk about the human experience and how you see the world, how you see people interacting. And I know you have a lot of experience working in different companies and working with something called psychological safety and communication. So with the experience you have, what would you say is one of the most common human behaviors that you encounter?
Oh, wow. What a huge question. The most common human behavior. I would say the most common thing that I see that creates problems, if we're going to go in that direction, because it's not very common that I go into a company and like, yay, we have a super high functioning team. That's not where I come in. I would say the lack of communication. So people not being aware of their own communication style and needs and how that is different from other people and how I should tailor my communication to you. And another element, I think what's very common, and of course, that has to do a little bit with communication, and we'll talk about this later, I think. But you can basically narrow down everything to, okay, this doesn't work because you don't have trust. So another thing that's very common is that you don't have people, especially like newly formed teams, you have people not challenging each other, saying yes to almost everything, not questioning, are we really doing the right things? You kind of have a bit of a group think. You're very keen on pleasing each other and you're very polite. A woman who, her name is Susan Whelan, so she's the one who created this integrated model of group development.
Okay.
So she looked at all different research on group development and looking at, so how do people behave in groups? What defines a high-performing team? And what she defined, so this is like not culturally specific, but in the first phase of a team, people have a lot of respect for each other, a lot of respect for each other's competencies, and they don't want to, like, you're kind of like tiptoeing around each other. According to research, this is like a human.
This is like a human behavior.
Yeah.
Then what happens over time when people start getting to know each other?
Well, so the first phase is when you have this initial politeness. And I didn't know this because, and I will answer the question, but it was when I worked at IKEA, I worked in the global people and culture team. I didn't know about team development at this point. And it was only afterwards that I could look back and be like, oh, this explains why when my leader asked a question to the team, it was quiet. Because people, we didn't feel comfortable to just be like, well, I think this, what do you think? And you had this like open debate. It was more like, oh, I'm probably not the best one to answer this, or that person knows better than me. And that's a very big sign. So when people start to get to know each other and you have at least an initial foundation of trust, you have clear objectives, clear goals, you know why you are a team, what happens is that you start to have conflict. And a lot of teams stays in this phase. So in the first phase, you're very dependent on the leader. In the second phase, it kind of becomes like a power struggle. Mm-hmm. Like it creates subgroups and people are questioning, like, is this really the right way to do it? And the way to overcome that is to really learn your communication styles and really be clear on who is supposed to do what and really like fight it out. It sounds really hard until you come into the third phase. And that's where things are really starting to establish themselves. But then you actually have a fourth phase and that's where the high performance is. Very few teams actually reach the high performance phase, which is really sad. And whenever, even if you have a team that's like really far up the different phases, when a new member enters the team, you go back.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So if you have high turnover,
yes,
that is a hindrance, yes, to development and change.
Yes.
Ah.
So that's actually a very expensive thing to have if you have high turnover, not just because it's very expensive to find new people and hire new people and onboard them before they come productive, but to also think about how does this new person impact the group dynamics in the team and how does that impact efficiency and productivity and creativity.
And well-being.
Yeah.
Because it becomes a reinforcing loop then.
Yeah.
Because if you have a workplace where people are not necessarily thriving, they're not feeling well, you normally have a higher turnover because people leave that job, new people comes in. Mm. But I didn't know that that actually slides everything back to the beginning.
Yeah.
So if you then already don't have a great starting point to move through those phases, it's like you're just walking on the same spot. You never really get anywhere.
Yeah.
So naturally, how far do different organizations usually come, different groups? Which phase is most common to just kind of like stick with?
There is probably research on this, but I think a lot of teams, unfortunately, maybe stay in like phase one or two.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Partly because of what you're just saying. If you're not thriving, something's off. People leave people. When you leave a company, you leave because things are not working. But if you have a strong team that is high performing, when someone starts, you will probably go through those phases very quickly because you have a strong foundation.
So it's like you just bring that person in and you just move them through the steps of getting to know each other and feeling safe.
Yeah.
So psychological safety, tell us more about that.
So psychological safety is something that is, speaking of group dynamics, it's basically what research shows is like the one key foundation, like a necessity for teams to be high performing. So it's about a group being safe for putting yourself at interpersonal risk. So speaking up with an idea, sharing your feedback, challenging someone, like coming with perhaps not very awesome ideas, without the fear of someone judging you, being angry with you, questioning you, to basically be like, hey, so what do you think about this? So if we think about the first phase of team development, when you're very scared of, oh, maybe I shouldn't say anything because this person is so much smarter than me, that's not psychological safety. Psychological safety comes with, oh, so you're saying this, but what do you think about that? Oh, no, I haven't thought about this. So Amy Edmondson, who is a researcher at Harvard University, she's the one who like popularized psychological safety. And in 1999, she did a research on teams in hospitals. So she looked at the level of mistakes that different teams made and how effective they were, like the quality of their performance. And her finding was that, wait a minute, the teams that make most mistakes are the teams that are most high performing. And she was so confounded by this. So she assigned a research assistant to replicate her research and do a little other things because she had this insight and she didn't want to prime that person. So what they found was that it's not that the team that's most productive do most mistakes, but they dare to share those mistakes. And when you share mistakes, you can learn from them. And so you can then see, is this a mistake that is avoidable, a mistake that we can create processes or increase our competence so that they will not happen in the future? Is it a mistake that is complex, being there were so many different things interacting here and we need to understand it and see what can we learn from that so it doesn't happen again? And then the third kind of mistakes is basically intelligent mistakes, mistakes that are like we're testing a hypothesis. We're getting insights that will drive us forward in terms of innovation. Intelligent mistakes are critical.
So it's creative mistakes,
exactly,
so to speak.
So those first two kinds of mistakes, unless they are brought to surface, you can't improve. If you don't have people saying, oh, I did a mistake with this patient here because something, then you can't change the routine that will prevent that from happening in the future.
Well, that's so interesting. So it was actually, most likely, all of the groups made an equal amount of mistakes, but when it was visible, that's the difference.
Mm. I actually read the other day that, so the nuclear disaster in Chernobyl in 1986, that actually was a result of not having psychological safety.
Oh.
Because if the people working in the plant had felt like they could raise concerns and say, you know what, this is not really working. And this, we can see that very often, really big problems, you can trace them back to someone not daring to say, oh, this is what I see.
So you say that we don't dare because we're afraid of judgment. Why are we so afraid of those things?
Because ultimately, if I think it's ultimately fear of being rejected, because it's about if I speak up about something. So no one has ever, well, maybe they have, but you don't really get fired or questioned for something you don't say. Basically, it's safe to keep things to yourself. But if we share them, people can get mad at us. They can fire us. They can exclude us. They can question our intelligence. They can question our worth as human beings, you know? And being included and being accepted and liked as a really strong human driving force.
I feel like that probably has the same shape and form in other groups other than the workplace, because it's based on the same fears of being judged, of being rejected, of not, of seeming stupid, as you said. I feel like this is something we see in friend groups as well, and then maybe it gets amplified in a work group because you're supposed to work as a team. You're not just supposed to interact as a team and just hang out with each other. You're supposed to actually produce something.
Yeah, because we have different expectations on ourselves and each other in a professional setting. So if we look at it, so classically, if you separate, you know, like your personal self from your professional self is supposed to be analytical, rational, whereas we don't have those expectations in our personal life. We have might have other expectations. But as like behavioral science shows over and over again, we are not rational human beings. I mean, we are analytical, but we're also emotional. The biggest mistake someone can make is to assume that people are being coherent, because we're not. We might think we are, but we're not. And so being able to remove that expectations of ourselves in the workplace and just also allow us to be human, because you can't really build trust. So trust is like the foundation for everything. And so psychological safety, the way I like to describe it is, so you have trust between two people, and that is something that builds over time. And I can feel like, oh, I can trust Maria either in a, I can trust that you will do the things you've said that you will do, or I can feel like I can trust you to, I can share my emotions with you. But in a group setting, it's not only enough to have trust between, so for example, an employee and the leader. You need to have interpersonal trust within the whole team. And psychological safety is like momentaneous. It's something that happens in the moment. Do I feel safe right now to share my perspective? So once I had a manager, and she was great at building like interpersonal relationships one-on-one, but we didn't get psychological safety in a group setting.
So then not between her and the group as a whole, but between the group
individually.
Like
So if you look at it sort of like a network thing where it's supposed to be like a line between everyone in the group, that's what you want to create.
And is it enough that there's one connection or like a couple of people that are not necessarily clicking for the whole group to break down? Or is it if the majority of the group is functioning well, is that enough?
That's a great question. I would say it depends on if one person feel it's not psychologically safe, it's not psychologically safe for that person. So other people can experience, but I feel safe to speak up. But if not the whole group feels that, you will not get the fullest out of the whole group.
And that is so dependent on individual, because we have such different needs to feel safe based on who we are, the experiences we have, our level of self-esteem, of self-compassion, of self-awareness, communication skills. It differs so much between people.
Yeah.
So there must be a lot of perspective taking in this, a lot of self-awareness, and a lot of also understanding how other people are different and how to approach that, how to give them that space.
So I'm a really big fan of like frameworks and models, and I always have like a paper and a pen and I draw things. But a model that I think is very, I think, useful to know about when we talk about these things, because what we're ultimately talking about is our ability to interact productively in a group setting, right? Yeah. So what is required to be able to interact and communicate and be creative and everything in a group setting is right what you're saying. So a model that I like to use is Yohari window.
Okay.
So it's from two researchers. It was made in the 1955. So it's basically a 2x2. If you have four squares. Mm-hmm. So the first square is what I know about myself and what you know about myself. So that's basically my open window. Those are things that if you know someone well, you will know more about them. So if you know someone well, you have a bigger window. So when you meet someone for the first time, it's like, okay, what can you physically know about me? What have I disclosed about myself? What have you read about things? But also, what have you observed about my behaviors? And then you have things that I know about me, but that you don't know about me. And if we don't know someone well, my hidden window, as that is really big. And the only way I can increase the open window in that direction is by self-disclosing, is to share things about myself. And doing that is, it can be very vulnerable. But by doing that, I can make it easier for you to interact with me. So when I start working with someone, unless I explain how I work, because I also work a lot with self-awareness and self-reflection, because that way I can speed up the process of us working greatly together. So if I just start talking to someone and my open window towards them is not very big, they could be like, oh my God, why is she just going on and talking in circles? And this doesn't make any sense. And I'm really starting to question her intelligence here. But if I can proactively open my window and say, just so you know, I'm an extroverted thinker. I think out loud and sometimes I go into derails, but I always have a point in the end. Mm. Bear with me. That way I can like meta address myself so they know how they can interpret me. Or I can say, you know, as a leader, if I ask questions to team members, I can be like, but it's of course up to you if you want to answer this. Mm. Because especially if you're in a position of power, people could be like, but now I have to answer this, so I have to do this. But if I can be like, this is what I mean, this is how I view the situation, and I can make it easier for them.
Let me know if it's okay.
Exactly. So the more we know each other, the bigger the open window is.
But the more you need to know yourself as well.
Exactly. And that is the next, if you look at in the other direction, we have things I don't know about me and things that you know about me, which is my blind window. And in order to decrease that window, I need to get feedback. You need to tell me, Kina, when you constantly interrupt me when I speak, that makes me feel like I'm not worthy of an opinion. And I can be like, oh my God, I interrupt people. That's so rude.
Because I'm so extroverted in my thinking, or because I just want to throw in my idea as soon as I have it.
But I need someone else to tell me. And speaking of psychological safety, if you don't have psychological safety, how many people will get that feedback? So one recommendation that I always have, especially if you're in a leadership position, if someone shares a perspective, an idea, constructive feedback, whatever, your job is literally to encourage that behavior. So you should say, thank you so much for sharing this. It doesn't matter if you don't agree. Like, your job is to make sure that that person will, the next time they have an idea, a feedback, whatever, to do that. But if I react being like, no, I don't, why are you saying that? Chances are that person won't share that with me again.
Yeah, that's true. So it's quite easy for it to actually break down.
Yeah.
Because when you lose that trust, you need to build that back up, which is going to take time.
Which is the really like hard part with trust, because it takes really long time to build, or really long, like you can facilitate that to speed it up. But it goes so quickly to make it go away. Yeah. I mean, just think about if you're in a relationship, how can you have a great relationship with a partner if you don't trust them? Same thing with your team.
So how do you build that trust?
So the most important thing is to dare to be vulnerable, to really allow someone to see who you are. Basically, it's about the more open you are and the more you get to know someone, the more you can relate to that person and the more you can trust them. So you wanted someone to experience the real you.
So you connect as humans.
Yeah.
Seeing like, okay, you also have human needs and human fears.
Yeah.
The way I do, you also mess up the way I do. There's maybe not so much of difference between us. So I'm a little bit less scared.
Yeah.
of messing up in front of you.
Yeah. I think, so I'm a big fan of research. There was this behavioral scientist in 97 called Arthur Aaron. He did a research project on interpersonal connection. So what he did was that he took a lot of different students and paired them up and then divided them into two groups. You have a lot of pairs here and a lot of pairs over here. And the first group got a list of questions to ask each other. And those were quite factual and shallow questions. Mm-hmm. Sort of like, what's your favorite holiday? And what year were you born? And stuff like that. The other group were given questions that maybe started as quite shallow, but progressively got deeper. You know, ending up in questions like, what's love to you? When was the last time you cried in front of someone? Whose death in your family would impact you the most? Sort of those kind of questions. And they only talked for 45 minutes. And what they saw then was when people afterwards rated their, like, the connection and how close they felt to each other, the people in the group, of course, with the deeper questions felt really close to each other. And so what he then did was that based on that rating, he went out and asked other people to rate how close they felt to the people closest to them. And when he compared that data with the group that felt really close to the people that they had this with, was that 30% of the people in the research group felt more close to the people they had talked to for 45 minutes than people who were closest to you in your life in general. And especially if you look at how many people that feel lonely in the world, like you're surrounded by people, but you're feeling lonely. Why is that? It's because you're not having that interpersonal connection with someone else.
Yeah.
Like you're not being seen and accepted and included. That's what we're longing for as human beings. And it's the same thing in the workplace.
Yeah. Because it's a large part of the time we spend during the day.
Yeah.
If you have a full-time job where you have a workplace that you go to and you socially interact with people, that is quite a large amount of time during your life. Mm. And therefore important that it's something that gives you energy, not something that drains energy. And but being vulnerable, I think, is something that most of us really struggle with. It's really scary to be vulnerable. Mm. How can you motivate people to do that?
The person that needs to start is the leader. You can't expect people in your team to be vulnerable and to share things unless you do it first. So it's a lot about, it can be a very vulnerable thing as a leader to just say, you know what? I don't know. I don't have an answer to this question. Showing your own fallibility and sharing your own mistakes. I mean, it doesn't need to be like, I'm going to share my entire life story, but just being, you know what? I tried this once and I failed and I was miserable. Because of XYZ. And just having, you know, members of your team hearing that could be like, oh, but this person who I look up to or who seems so competent, they struggle too. So I worked a lot with younger people. And when I talk about imposter syndrome, you know, the feeling, when will they figure out I'm a fraud? Just by speaking up and talking about it has allowed for so many people to say, but I feel like that. Otherwise, they would never have done that.
So if someone goes first, you can recognize yourself in that and you can go, you can share that feeling and go like, hey, we have something in common
here.
I feel like a fraud as well.
Yeah. So I think as a leader, it's really important to lead by example in this regard and be like, you know what? I'm human too. Mm. I mean, it sounds so weird when I say that because it's so obvious. But in a work setting, when you really have those very often facades or like you want to keep up appearances because also like you're in a relationship where I'm being paid to produce something and this is like a relationship where my personality should maybe not be in the mix. But what we need to remember is that not only do we need that connection to thrive as individuals, we also need that to establish the trust that will build psychological safety, that will produce creativity, that will produce innovation, that we are all dependent on to succeed in today's world.
That will produce the mistakes, the course correction, the learning, the progress.
Yeah. Because no one in the history ever has been innovative and creative with, you know, being a manager standing in front of you like, be innovative.
Yeah, I love this. I think it shows how we interact in a workplace can sometimes be like a magnification glass into how we function in society, because it becomes this expanded view of how we do that. But I think also, especially in today's society, it's not uncommon that success, career, productivity, all of those things become contingencies of self-esteem, as it's called, that we connect our self-esteem and our self-worth to the image that we're projecting to others. So, for example, I'm very competent, I'm very well-dressed, I'm very productive, I'm very all of those things that we believe that we need to be. And if you have a part of your self-esteem tightly connected to how you perform, how you are perceived to perform, your perceived competency, this must become so much more difficult. Mm-hmm. Being vulnerable then and breaking that image a bit and saying, hey, I actually don't know when my self-esteem is connected to actually knowing all the time, then that vulnerability becomes even more difficult.
And I think that really goes with, because what you're saying now is if we have that view, which a lot of us have, we haven't aligned our view of the world with what the world actually looks like. Because today, as things move so quickly and so fast, you know, in this VUCA world where everything is volatile and uncertain and complex and ambiguous, things are just changing very quickly. We cannot know, like no one has the answers of what tomorrow will look like.
And also if you have all the answers, then you're trying to create a world that is just based on yourself.
Yeah.
Because we have our own different viewpoints, our own different perspectives, our own background. So all of the answers that are in my head are based on me. Other people do that too, but from a completely different standpoint. So we need to merge our worlds rather than me trying to impose my world or expecting other people to understand my world. Because as you said in the beginning, I think that's a lot of the communication breakdown.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
It's like, I believe that all of these things are true. If you don't align with that, there's something wrong with you.
No, that's really true. I actually got an article the other day from a colleague at a different company. She sent this to me and it was from Dagens Nyheter, where a researcher within psychology had looked at why so many men get into management positions. Because when he looked at it, it was like, you're not more qualified, but the reason why you get there is because your self-confidence is so high. And you mistake great leadership for confidence, which is also something, because if you have that big, I know best,
yeah,
what's the impact that will have on your team?
It's the old view that we have of leadership is that it's supposed to be so authoritative.
Because what you want to do is that you want to hire people who are better than you.
Yeah.
Who know things that you don't know. And then you want to be the facilitator and asking the questions and being the facilitator of solving those problems together. So your view of your role as a leader needs to shift in order to create that. But also in terms of this is my worldview and this is your worldview, having that humbleness, but also, so not only being aware of who am I and how do I work and what is my view of the world, but also being curious, what's your view of the world? What do you need? So what's your perspective on this? So I think it's so interesting because speaking of communication, once I had to go in between a manager and an employee, where it was so clear to me that they had completely different personalities and they had so different communication styles. And just by me being aware of their differences and just being like, okay, so you're valuing results, you're very direct, you're very assertive, you're very concrete, you value actions, task-oriented person. And the other one was more a people-centric person, you know, talking more in abstract terms, sharing ideas, maybe talking more in circles. And they just like went head to head.
And you came in objectively looking at their closed windows.
Yes. I actually had to explain that. I felt like I was a translator.
Yeah.
I actually explained this to them. I was like, just so you know, it's like you're speaking Chinese and you're speaking Italian. And now I'm going to make sure that you understand each other. So in Chinese, this is what that means. And in Italian, this is what that means. Yeah. And they were like, oh, but why didn't you say so? So I often talk about like asking for a receipt. If we talk about something, just so we're clear, like, what are you now going to do? Oh yeah, I will do this or that and that because X, Y, Z. Okay, yes. Or no, we talked about this as well. Oh yeah, people don't really, they filter. So asking for a receipt is a very good aspect of just making sure I've had so many leaders who are like, this team member, like, he just never does what we have agreed on. I was like, are you sure you did agree?
Did you really agree?
Exactly. How clear was this? But it was super clear. Yeah, to you. Was it clear to the other person?
And that's
why. And how do you know?
Yeah, how do you know it was clear? Also, I think by the end of a meeting with several different people to go like, okay, so what are the next actions that are the follow-up from what we just discussed and who is in charge of what?
Yes.
So what are the things we're actually supposed to do here? Okay, the next step is to do this thing, and that thing. Who's going to take the lead on which? Mm. Because often in meetings, we sit, we talk, we have all kinds of ideas. People have all kinds of notes. And then the meeting ends. And 2 months later, nothing has really happened. We haven't used that information because if everybody's in charge, nobody's in charge. It needs to be clear.
Another element of that, it should also be really clear who follows up.
Oh, yeah.
So following up is one of the most, also for a leader, it's not enough to say, okay, we agree that you will do this. You also need to follow up.
But as a form of accountability?
Yes. Accountability is, so if we look at what drives learning and high performance, so if we can all agree that in today's society, we continuously need to learn because we don't have the answers and things are changing so quickly. I usually like the example of, so back in the day, it could take an airplane company maybe 50, 60, 70 years to reach an audience or a customer base of 50 million people. For Facebook, that took 3 years. For Pokemon Go, that took 19 days.
19 days?
Yes. Things are moving so quickly and we need to learn. And in order to learn, we need to have psychological safety and we also need to have accountability. Mm. We need to make sure that we know what the requirements are of us. We need to agree on what those requirements are on us. They should be like high standards because otherwise we will just go into comfort mode. And we need to be held accountable to those standards.
And know when that is going to happen. So we're going to catch up again on this subject in a week.
Exactly.
Because then you know, okay, I need to get going on this. I need to prepare whatever the draft is. I need to do these things because we need to discuss it again within this time frame. Mm.
That's why coaching is so efficient. So when I have coaching clients and like we have scheduled, like every other week we talk at this time. And if they know, okay, so I'm paying for this time and on Thursday I'm meeting Kina and I'm supposed to have done this, I better get that done.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I will come there and I will be like, so why haven't you done this? That will just be a waste of their time and their money. So I've had a lot of people who be like, I've made so much progress because, you know, I don't want to come to our meetings and not having done what I said I would do. And just imagine if you can take that accountability to your workplace. So I've also had a lot of leaders who are, and I think a lot of people in management positions can relate to this, when you have someone who's not performing. Talking about someone's performance is for some reason super scary. Because as you were mentioning before, I have my value, I'm competent, I'm doing this, blah, blah, blah. But if we can be like, so I have feedback to help you course correct and develop, that's actually very helpful. But also, you need to have that psychological safety as a foundation for that person to feel safe to receive feedback and to show vulnerability. Like maybe there's something under the surface as to why that person hasn't performed. But what usually is the case when people say, so this person is not performing and I want to give feedback. And my question is always, does that person know what the bar for their performance is? So they're not doing their job enough.
Because like, they don't know what their job is.
Exactly. No, but that you're laughing, but a lot of people are just running around doing stuff.
Yeah.
But just being really clear. So I expect you to, having finished this project and having reached this amount of people and X, Y, Z within this time frame, and I will support you and I will coach you. And if you're not on par, if you're not progressing, we need to have a discussion on that. We're not doing anyone a favor by not saying, so Maria, I see that you haven't reached your target for this week. Yeah. Do you want to talk about that?
This must lead to so much stress in the workplace. Because if you, as an employee, don't really know what you're expected to do and at what pace, it's so easy to feel like you're not doing anything right.
Yes, unclear expectations is really a driver of stress.
And it leads to, any form of lack of control, lack of clarity. We have a fear of the unknown. And if your entire work situation is a little bit an unknown, that drives stress. Mm. It makes you afraid that, a bit like the imposter syndrome, at any moment, I'm just going to find out that I'm not doing anything right. I'm trying to do everything right, but I don't know if I am. Mm.
I actually had a burnout while working in a company where the expectations on me were not clear. Yeah. And I continuously asked for them, and it just didn't happen. And I wasn't the only one. I think we were 5 or 6 people at the same time with a burnout.
Yeah. So when it is not clear, we're assuming that we're not doing enough. Mm. We're assuming that we're not worth enough. We're assuming that people have a negative view on us rather than a positive view on us.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's a lot connected to our self-worth. I think a lot of people in today's society, especially in our Western society, which is the one I know, is we have low self-esteem. Our self-esteem, our self-worth is connected to other people's opinion of us, to how we perform in this world. And that leads to a society where people are only presenting the good sides. It's a bit of an Instagram world where we're just showing off the good parts and we're not talking about the bad parts. Mm. So then, since you're aware most often of your own bad parts, you feel like you're worse than everybody else. Mm. Everybody else seems to be so successful. Everybody else seems to be so sure of themselves. Everybody else seems to be so happy. I'm not. What's wrong with me? So we tend to believe negative things about ourselves because we're referencing against a world where we're not communicating around these human aspects, where we're not communicating about how we're all kind of messed up, usually in a little bit the same way. What are your thoughts on compassion in the workplace, compassion within groups?
No, I think that's a really good question. And especially what you're saying, I was just thinking as you were speaking, like, what if we could make people not, like, if the workplace could be a catalyst where people would actually start feeling like they don't have to hide to really show that. And compassion is really important because if I share something about myself, if I'm vulnerable, so if I'm putting myself at emotional risk, if that's not met with compassion, chances are I will not open up again. So compassion is super important, and it's not a coincidence that now research is showing the biggest leadership trait impacting general performance is empathy. I read some in the Wall Street Journal that 20% of American companies, I don't have a source of this, it was just in Wall Street Journal, are sending their management teams on empathy courses, which is just sad that they have to do that. You know, but it also shows that being able to put yourself in others' shoes and mirror other people's emotions and being aware of your own emotions and all of those things, like these soft human interconnection skills, are super important.
Because they're creating this foundation of psychological safety. And I think a lot of people misunderstand that vulnerability has to be about telling people exactly what have happened. But you don't have to. It's enough to talk about how you've been impacted by things. You can say, well, I did have some traumatic experiences in the past, and they have caused me to feel this way, or they have caused me to interact in this way. You don't have to disclose. You don't have to tell them all of the most darkest secrets that you feel like you have. You just need to talk about how it's impacting you. You don't have to go through everything in detail, because those details are yours. But I think people mistake vulnerability for disclosing things that you just don't want to talk about.
And also, I think vulnerability is subjective. So I can talk about stuff that has happened in my past without being vulnerable. So that could just be, for me, disclosing information. But sharing feedback is a very vulnerable thing. You know, when you say this, that really hurts me.
Yeah, if you include yourself in the feedback, if you include your feelings in the feedback.
It is difficult, but that's the thing, like just starting to opening up and sharing things, and it's like a spiral, like you don't have to go big. It could be as a team that has never worked with getting to know each other. It could be like So this is what I like to do on my spare time. Yeah. These are things I'm really good at. These are things I want to be better at. Yeah. Like just like disclosing some kind of information that makes you a little bit more human so that I can meet you with compassion. Oh, so this person who is always so snarky with me, maybe they sleep very poorly. And now I know. Like it could be those very trivial things.
So what I think is so interesting and that we touched on a lot here today is how this interpersonal communication and how we do that, how we approach ourselves and other people, how important that is, both for groups, for the workplace, for productivity, but also for our own health. Health in the workplace, our general well-being, and how these things can actually be taught. You can actually learn more about how to communicate. You can learn how to be intentional in how you think about yourself and how you think about other people. And you can learn to be more of an active listener. You can learn how to be curious about other people.
And I think what I really want people to understand is how much of a driver to business outcomes this is. People are like, yeah, but we're just so focused on cutting back on costs and we need to have productivity. But if you're not selling stuff that you can put in a storage, but you're actually selling what is a product of a human mind, then please nurture that human mind and nurture people's ability to think well together.
To give space for creativity, to give space for growth, for making mistakes and course correcting.
Exactly.
So that you can progress as a group, as a society, and just people in themselves. Mm. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.